Good morning. Go ahead and be seated. And the first case we have on calendar is docket 66644, Cox versus State. And Ms. Ross, are you ready to proceed?
Yes, thank you, Your Honor.
Okay.
Good morning, Your Honors. My name is Katrina Ross. I'm an attorney at the Clark County Public Defender's Office, and I represent Robert Cox in this matter. I'd like to reserve 5 minutes for rebuttal, please.
Sure.
There's no evidence and no reason to think that Mr. Cox was intentionally setting out to hurt anybody that day, and no one takes that position. Those are direct words from Judge Alyssa Kadish the moment before she sentenced Mr. Cox in this case. And that quote from Judge Kadish at Mr. Cox's sentencing perfectly shows up why we are here today. Up until the very moment Mr. Cox was sentenced, the court and the evidence clearly characterized what happened that day as an accident. And what is interesting in this case are the facts, because there are very few contested facts. Instead, this trial turned on taking a certain set of facts and forcing them to fit a crime that should never have even been charged. It is undisputed in the record that Mr. Cox struck Samantha Campos. It's also undisputed that Mr. Cox was not looking at the time that he hit her. Mr. Cox then stopped his car, stayed at the scene, talked to some people, and ensured that Samantha was being treated by the paramedics. In fact, he stayed until the paramedics took Ms. Campos away in an ambulance. He left only after the situation became dynamic and was contacted by Samantha's father.
As to the facts, there seemed to be a question in the record whether he exchanged information with anyone as to what was going on.
Correct, Your Honor. And I would like to address that point. NRS 434E.010 lies out what a driver needs to do after an accident. First, the driver shall stop the vehicle, and Mr. Cox clearly did that in this case. Then the driver shall provide name, registration, and address to any person injured. There's no provision in that statute that requires Mr. Cox to provide information to any other person except the injured party. Now, there's an argument that can be made.
Did he provide it to the injured party?
He did not, Your Honor. And per Nevada law, what he did was permissible. When it is not practical to provide information, the law does not require criminal liability if that
then
law.
Then why was it not practical when all he had to do is jot it down on a napkin, a handkerchief, a piece of newsprint, something?
And Your Honor, it was not practical, one, because of the medical treatment that was there. Ms. Campos was undergoing medical treatment in an ambulance, had been taken away, not taken away from the scene, but been removed from direct contact by Mr. Cox and was taken away. Her mother was also in the ambulance at that time. It also was not practical because of the hostility and violence that you saw at the scene. And New York versus Moran, 156.
Also, wasn't there some testimony that he said he had to go pick someone up? That's why he couldn't stay around?
There was testimony regarding that, but there was also uncontroverted testimony that there were multiple witnesses at the scene that saw a Hispanic male angrily gesticulating at my client. From even across the street, the testimony was that...
Did he confront him, or did he make sure it was across the street only?
No. The witness was across the street and witnessed an angry Hispanic male confront Mr. Cox as Mr. Cox was walking away to his car, where normally registration information is kept. He got in his car and the Hispanic male reached into the window. That's when Mr. Cox left. Yes, Your Honor.
Yeah. How was this raised below?
How was this raised as far as the issue of the unconstitutionality of the leaving the scene
yes.
statute? When we argued at trial that the information that needed to be provided was license and registration, we argued that his name was given, his license plate was given, and the constitutionality of any statute can be raised at any time, including on this appeal. We clearly argued that we thought that the facts that were raised showed that he provided information.
Well, and it doesn't appear, I think you provided about 3 pages of briefing on that entire issue on the constitutionality. That's what seems to me that wasn't your primary focus.
Well, I think it's overstatement to even call it briefing, Justice Perry. Why did you do fast track in this case? Why didn't we, if such important issues with a person being convicted of serious felonies, why would you not do full briefing in this case?
We first did the motion for a new trial, which included some additional briefing on this issue. And then when we did the fast-track statement, I know it was a concern with an issue of timing, whether or not we could get these issues before Your Honors, before Mr. Cox is even done serving his prison sentence. When we did the fast-track and we raised these issues, it was clear to us that the issues laid out are fairly clear-cut because there are not a lot of facts that are in dispute here. And when we raised the issues of whether or not he provided enough information, the law in Nevada is fairly clear. When a statute is plain and unambiguous as to the meaning, it cannot be expanded, and that's Charlie Brown Construction Company versus Boulder City, Nevada. The plain meaning of the statute says Mr. Cox is required to give information to the injured party. It does not say anything about giving information to anyone else at the scene. It does say that they're required to give information to police at the scene. However, the police were not even at the scene. And there is, furthermore, Nevada law that says if the police are not there, the driver then shall provide information regarding the accident to police forthwith. And that brings us to another one of our arguments regarding forthwith and whether or not that is constitutionally or unconstitutionally vague.
Why isn't it easily and ordinarily understood?
The term forthwith?
Forthwith is, to me, right away.
Sure, forthwith to you is right away. As soon as practical, forthwith can be defined by any number of people any different ways. And in fact, the state uses dictionary.com to define forthwith as immediately. Even immediately can be construed to be ambiguous. Unless we have a set definition of time, like other statutes give, there's a statute, I believe, in Kentucky that says you must provide it within 12 hours. There's another statute that says within one day. Here there is no specific timing requirement. And any multiple number of police officers or district attorneys who investigate and handle this case could define forthwith as any number of time. If you use a word that is vague, such as forthwith, if you define that with another vague word, such as right away or immediately, you still don't have a set amount of time that needs to go. There was testimony that Mr. Cox did not have his license with him that day. There was testimony from his wife that he was going home, picking up his wife, going to get his license. His wife said, you need to calm down, and then they were going to go to Sunrise Hospital because Mr. Cox knew that's where they had taken Samantha. Police never contacted him at the scene. He didn't have a cell phone with him at the scene. Ambulance responded to the scene, and he required. And when he went home, I believe that it's justified that he can take a moment to compose himself after a 60-year-old disabled veteran had just struck a little girl in parking lot.
Counsel, can we get to your position as to whether or not dangerous driving could support an aggravated battery conviction?
Yes, thank you. Thank you, Your Honor. There is clear law in Nevada that indicates what a battery is, and a battery is defined as a willful and intentional use of force upon a person of another. Here in this case, our argument has always been that Mr. Cox did not have the intent to willfully use force upon a person of another, and clearly that this was not a battery. It was an accident. Nevada law defines an accident in McDonald v. Sheriff as a battery charge cannot stand when the record reflects that the alleged injury was accidentally inflicted. And furthermore, NRS 194.010 subsection 6, it says, persons who committed an act through misfortune or accident with no evil design or intent are not liable to punishment for criminal conduct.
So your argument basically is he has to intend to do this. He can't be just reckless.
Correct, Your Honor. There is a mode that the state could have proceeded on here in the state of Nevada to charge Mr. Cox with reckless driving with substantial bodily injury. They chose not to. They chose instead to charge him with battery with a deadly weapon, which, albeit is a general intent crime, raises the level of just acting recklessly to willfully and intending to strike or to physically touch another human being. And in this case, by allowing the state to argue that Mr. Cox intentionally drove recklessly and that was enough to somehow raise it to the level of intent. It was a denial of due process rights.
Well, and again, the allegations, even that he was driving recklessly, were what? That he was looking down, he was looking at his console.
Correct.
And perhaps driving too fast. And is there any more?
There is no more, Your Honor. And the only person that could testify to the fact that Mr. Cox was driving recklessly was the mother of the little girl. The mother who admitted she was not holding the hand, who was not looking at the little girl, who was looking at the car, had enough time to see that he was looking down at the car, or at the console, and yet did not somehow protect her child. And I understand that there's no need to shift liability here.
Making the mother at fault for her little girl's accident is the wrong way to argue this case.
And
I'm just being very blunt to you. In terms of your argument.
I completely understand that, Your Honor. But why I raise that is because this is a question of civil liability when an accident happens.
Well, we'd like you to speak to the criminal and the intent, any history of battery and why we shouldn't look at it. Tell us about that.
And I'd like to point out a case that the Honorable Justice Perry decided in 2014, Byers, which gave a little bit of clarity on the battery conviction. And in Byers, the actual language of the case says that battery, it defines battery as any willful and unlawful use of force or violence upon the person of another. Then it looks to California, whose battery statute Nevada's is based on, and says that battery can be interpreted broadly to say that it's the intentional and unwanted exertion of force upon another, however slight. And then further, it defines battery as the prosecutor need only prove that the defendant actually intended to commit a willful and unlawful use of force or violence upon the person of another. Here, the prosecution can't prove that Robert Cox intended to commit a willful and unlawful use of force upon the person of another. And to distinguish the Byers case with this case, because Byers does define battery broadly. In that case, it was a case regarding a forced blood draw when Byers flailed around and hit a police officer. In that case, Byers intended to physically resist the blood draw. That was his intent. He physically intended to resist the blood draw by moving his arms. Because of that intent to physically resist, he struck another officer. In this case, you don't even have an intent to strike another person. If you get in a car and you intend to drive, and that intent to drive can be commuted to intent to striking any other person, it goes against the public policy of the state of Nevada. Here in this case, Mr. Cox did not even see a person in front of him. How can he intend to strike someone when he is not even aware that a person is in his way? And that's why it should have been charged as reckless driving with substantial bodily harm. We have a law that covers what happened here. The law of battery does not cover the facts here.
Okay. Yeah, you've got about 3 minutes left. You want to reserve it?
Yes. Thank you, Your Honor.
Okay.
Thank you very much.
Okay, Mr. Ports, are you ready?
Yes, Your Honor. Thank you. Good morning. May it please the Court. Nick Ports from the Clark County District Attorney's Office on behalf of the State of Nevada. Responded in the instant appeal. If I may, I'd like to begin with where counsel was ending on the issue of the requisite mental intent or mental state required for the general intent under Nevada's battery statute. Now, obviously, there's no dispute that the battery is a general intent crime as defined by Byers, by this court, as both parties fully recognize in the matter before the court. And as we've already established, NRS 200.481 defines battery as a willful and unlawful use of force upon the person of another.
Where's the willful and unlawful aspect to this?
In this particular case?
Yes.
Yes, Your Honor. That and that would be where we cite to the California case law that Byers references in its definition of battery as a general intent crime. The fundamental crux of the issue at this point, I think that the state is getting at, is that the defense's definition of general intent in battery is asking this court to adopt a specific intent or render battery a specific intent crime. The defense is saying that for general intent to exist, the defendant must intend the unlawful use of force upon the person of another. And that's a direct quote from the fast track statement on pages 20 and 13, as well as a representation made by counsel here. They're literally saying that not only must there be a use of force, but there must be an intent of that use of force. By its very nature, that is establishing battery as a specific intent crime, that the defendant must intend to batter his victim.
But aren't you going the opposite direction and trying to establish it as a strict liability crime? Strict liability. And there's usually a jury instruction that there has to be a operation between intent and act and intent.
And that instruction was provided to the jurors in this case as well. The suggestion that the defendant, that the defense asked for, is that the defendant had to actually intend to strike this victim. The state's position is that that is not general intent. That is specific intent. And here's where, if I could provide just a simple example. If I were to say, be in a room with another person and just out of curiosity want to see if I could swing my fist as hard as I could and get as close as I could to that person without hitting them, and then I engage in that act and I actually strike that person, I think few legal scholars or practitioners would dispute that that striking constitutes a battery, even though my intention was only to see how close I could get swinging as fast as I could. Now, under the proposed theory of general intent that's provided by the defense in this case, that would not be a battery because I did not intend to strike my victim. That's why the defendant's position on what constitutes general intent for battery does not comport with common sense, and it does not comport with our common law understanding of general intent.
Counsel, you gave us a hypothetical about swinging your fist, but in this case we have another hypothetical, and that's looking down at the console while driving. And unfortunately, so many of us while driving the vehicle from time to time get distracted by looking down at a radio or looking down at our console or looking at our watch, looking at everything but the road.
Understood.
While driving. Now, is that, from the standpoint, willful?
Well, and that's
willfully, intentionally,
absolutely,
doing something.
And I understand the embracing that concept here is sort of the rub. What we're looking at is it willful? That's why the state is referencing to the California cases, Laura v.
State. But are you doing so in a manner that you're attempting or feeling you might injure someone, I guess?
The response to that, Your Honor, would be it is an entirely circumstantial set of facts and dependent on the case at hand. Now, in this case, we're not dealing with someone simply looking away as he's driving down the road and accidentally striking someone. The evidence that was presented to the jury was that he was driving at a high rate of speed, that he was on the wrong side of the road, that he was also in the middle of a commercial parking lot on a Saturday afternoon of a busy commercial center. And that is a situation in which people typically engage in a slower speed and are observant of their surroundings. What the state is saying, his intent, the act, was to drive in a very dangerous manner, a manner inherently dangerous to others.
Our query, is that intentionally for a battery, or is that just reckless?
Well, Your Honor, I think that it can be, pursuant to the general intent instructions, if we go through the California case law that this court has cited.
What about the Nevada case law that we have as to battery?
Well, Nevada case law.
And the statute.
Yes, that's correct, Your Honor. And again, the state would submit that yes, it does, because the intent is to commit the act of driving in a manner that is reckless or dangerous to others, inherently dangerous to others, and then consciously deciding not to or consciously disregarding that safety. So, for instance, a difference, and listen, I understand that reckless driving could have been charged in this case. There are plenty of cases and plenty of crimes that arise out of the same set of facts and circumstances.
Isn't that what that statute 484.653 really contemplates, is this type of a situation?
Certainly, but that does not preclude the state from charging other crimes that arise out of those facts and circumstances.
Well, there's plenty of cases out there. Hobbs versus State certainly references exerting force against another person, and intent is certainly an aspect of that. I mean, how do you exert force against another when it's basically indicated as a intentional and unwanted exertion of force, however slight? That was Hobbs.
Well, and again, when we're talking about the general intent, I think we have to look at not only it's not an intent to commit the act of battery itself, it's an intent to engage in an act that results in the battery. So returning back to my hypothetical of swinging at someone, you're not intending to strike that person, but are you engaging in a conduct that is dangerous to that person, and are you disregarding the fact that you may cause that harm, then is there intent, is there a general intent to commit a battery? Even though I didn't mean to hit him, I hit him. Is there a general intent for battery? The state would submit, yes, there is, because I consciously disregarded the safety of that individual, engaged in a dangerous act, and I willfully chose to swing my hand. The act was...
Here, there wasn't even indication that he knew there was an individual in the area.
And that's why...
And you're not claiming that he saw the individual while he was acting in this, as you say, reckless manner.
Correct. The state's position is that he intentionally chose the act that he committed that constituted the battery was that he intentionally chose to drive, or excuse me, the requisite mental state was that he intended to drive in this particular manner. Now, why I say that this revolves around circumstantial evidence is we could differentiate this as why this could be considered a battery versus other situations where there might be reckless driving but not a battery.
So how do you really limit this? Does that also apply to a situation where somebody is speeding and driving way too fast for the conditions and a kid runs out in front of them just runs across the street
and again,
unexpectedly?
Of course. And that is why I, again, am referencing this to being a very circumstantial set of facts. What matters is the law that's presented to the jury. So if we're talking about, for instance, the hypothetical that you've given, those sets of circumstances may or may not lead a jury to believe that someone was engaging in a particular course of conduct that was inherently dangerous to others and disregarding it. Now, we'd have to look at the facts and circumstances of that case.
The statute says is inherently dangerous to others. I disagree with you.
Well, I would take, for instance, say, let's do another hypothetical with a car striking someone. Say the defendant's sitting in an empty parking lot at 2 in the morning and decides that he wants to just start doing donuts or driving in circles at a high rate of speed. Before he does this, he looks around and there's no one around. And as he's doing it, someone comes across and he strikes them. Now, you would be hard-pressed to suggest that there was some sort of intent under the California case law that the state cites to.
But what you're saying is it's a jury question in all these cases. If somebody runs over somebody, of course it's inherently dangerous as far as striking somebody who's on foot when you're driving a vehicle. So that's why you never answered my question about, aren't you taking this to strict liability on all hit cases where people are run over by a car?
No, Your Honor, because, one, you have to establish, again, that the manner in which they were driving that vehicle was inherently dangerous to others. And then on top of that, beyond what would merely be required for establishing recklessness in this case, someone driving recklessly without any sort of posing any danger to another person and then injuring that person would clearly constitute or would be sufficient to charge with a reckless charge that the defense is suggesting. Now, why I say it's circumstantial, we're not creating strict liability. You have to establish, and again, going back to that California case law, the nature of the manner in which they were driving, the circumstances in which they were driving, where they were driving, how they were driving, what was going on, when they engaged and chose to engage in this act that resulted in the harm. So that's where it comes into a jury question as to whether or not a battery occurred if we adopt the California case law, state of Laura, and gross indulgence, and People v. Brucker that are cited in the state's brief. So there are, if we look at it, just returning to those cases, which, you know, Laura is the case that this court cited to as for holding that battery is a general intent crime, noting that Nevada's battery statute is based on California's battery statute, and looking to Laura for guidance in declaring battery as a general intent crime. We have in Laura, as with all general intent crimes, the requisite mental state entails only to do the act that causes the harm. Now, in this case, the defense is saying the act has to be committing the battery. That's specific intent.
Well, counsel, we still have, it's a hard stretch. We still have Byers, which is a 2014 opinion that talks about willful means, a purpose, or willingness to commit the act in question. But and before your time gets away, you're about 3:33. You haven't discussed the leaving the scene argument that was raised.
Yes, Your Honor.
And there's also the unconstitutionality of that issue. So if you want to talk about both those with the time you got left, that'd be great.
Yes, of course. Thank you. With regards to whether or not the statute is unconstitutionally vague, the defense's challenge is essentially to the language of it being of reporting being forthwith. As defense has noted, as the state has noted, as the court has noted, forthwith seems to clearly comport with the idea that it is to respond immediately or without delay. Now, for the standard for a statute to be void for vagueness, there has to be the burden on the appellant here is to prove two things. One, that it fails to provide sufficient notice that would enable a person to understand what was prohibited, and two, that it authorizes or encourages and arbitrary or discriminatory enforcement. I would note that the defense has not addressed that second prong of this standard, and therefore I don't think they're capable of prevailing on this opinion on this particular issue. Furthermore, with regard to the first prong, forthwith, as we noted, is clear. The statute clearly prohibits any sort of delay in reporting. Now, in this case, with regards to the sufficiency of the evidence, the defendant is attempting to claim that he provided information or he could not provide information to the injured party. First of all, that issue was not raised at trial pursuant to, as referenced in our fast-track response. But it also would essentially nullify the statute under the defense or the appellant's interpretation of the statute. There would be absolutely no duty to stop or provide information if the individual is incapacitated or too young to receive the information or is in fact dead when the statute clearly contemplates and applies to accidents resulting in injury or death. As to whether or not he provided information, the claim that he was not concealing his license plates as he drove away, as he fled the scene, constitutes providing information, I think is clearly not the defendant complying with the statute, but rather violating the statute, fleeing the scene. They were just lucky that there were vigilant citizens there to take down his license plate number. Now, the defendant tries to justify his leaving the scene because the police were not present. At trial, the evidence clearly came out that the defendant was told to wait because the police were coming. The statute has two requirements. You have to provide information to the injured party, but you also must provide such information to any police officer on the scene of the accident or who is investigating the accident. The defendant was on notice that the police were on their way. They arrived shortly after he left. He left the scene before the police could get there. Now, as to whether he responded forthwith, I would note that as the evidence came out at trial, the defendant lived 1 mile away from the scene of the accident. It was more than 50 minutes before police were able to determine his address, show up at his address, determine that his car was there and that he was, in fact, home. He did not answer the door. He was in the back bathroom. He came out with no shoes on, and he was smoking a cigarette. And the most important statement, and it's a quote and piece of evidence that was not addressed by the defense, is the defendant's statement when he chastised his wife and son for letting the police in. That's a clear indication of his willingness or desire not to report. And I thank you for your time.
Thank you. Okay, you've got about 2 minutes and 54 seconds.
Thank you, Your Honors. And just very briefly regarding the vagueness, the arbitrary enforcement will come in. When you have a law enforcement agency as large as Metro is, if you ask each certain individual cop, how do you define forthwith, you're going to get a variety of answers. Therefore, it cannot be enforced the same with every incident. But really, the crux of this case that we've talked about today is intent. And the state misses the point completely regarding general intent versus specific intent. General intent, you have to intend the act. Specific intent is you have to intend the outcome. If Mr. Cox saw a little girl in the middle of the parking lot and said, I'm going to run down that little girl with my car, that is specifically intending the outcome of his actions.
It's also attempted murder.
Correct, Your Honor, and it would be charged as such. However, general intent, you just have to intend the act. And here, even Judge Kadish says in a bench conference, you don't have the intent to strike her. There was no intent whatsoever to exercise willful and unlawful use of force on a person of another, because, frankly, Mr. Cox didn't even know a person existed in his lane of traffic. The state's own argument here today was that the intent was to drive recklessly. If you intend to drive recklessly and should be held criminally liable for that, then you need to be charged with reckless driving so that the state can, or the defense can be put on notice and that the due process rights guaranteed by our Constitution can be afforded to the clients. In Nevada, there is, in the law of the realm of battery, there is no language regarding a conscious disregard of safety or acting in an inherently reckless manner. If you're using recklessness to define battery, you essentially morph two crimes into one. Here, even in the broadest definition of battery, you still need a willful intent to contact another individual. If you just intend to drive the car in a certain manner, and I know the state used an example, I'd like to show my own hypothetical of, if you were driving down the interstate and you change lanes without using your blinker, you intend that action. You intend to change lanes without using your blinker. Say you sideswipe a car. Your intent to change lanes without that blinker then transfers enough, according to the state's argument, for your intent to hit another car. Even using general intent, the intent in that case would be to drive recklessly. If the state wanted to make that argument, they needed to have put us on notice that they intended to try Mr. Cox on a reckless driving charge, not on a requisite battery charge. And Your Honor raised a good point about, is it a jury question? The outcome of this trial and what the jury would have been deliberating on would have been inherently different if the state was not allowed to argue reckless driving and instead was forced to comport to proving the elements of a battery. Clearly, by not doing that, they violated Mr. Cox's due process rights. And I see that my time is up, so thank you very much, Your Honor.
All right, counsel, thank you both for the briefing and your excellent arguments today. This matter will stand submitted. Thank you.